Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, we'll be checking in with Charlie Sturgis with our Mountain Trails Foundation report. Also, Park City Rotary Club President Corey Forsling, with Park City Rotary has details about this year's Scaled Back Miners Day. Park City Council Member Tim Henney on with a recap of last night's meeting, and finally be talking with the Executive Director of Park City Community Foundation, Katie Wright. She'll have details on applying for a Climate Fund grant, as well as nominees they're looking for the Tricia Worthington Community Service Awards. Right now, though, on the phone with us, we've got the Executive Director of Mountain Trails Foundation, Charlie Sturgis. Good morning, Charlie.
Good morning, Leslie. Lots of things to talk about for this morning. Let me start off with we are wrapping up the Jupiter Peaks People Chase, so appreciate all those people who signed up and ran it virtually. We know it was a little different, but hey, you know, we got to do what we can do in this day and age. Also, this also means that we're ready to start the Mid-Mountain Marathon. So the Mid-Mountain Marathon is marked. It's marked with blue again, blue tape, and it is marked in a minimal way, so because the markings will be out there for the month. So what we do want people to do is take a look, of course, on the site and make sure they understand where the course goes. The big change, though, Leslie, will be there will be no starting loop up at Deer Valley. You'll be running from up at Silver Lake all the way across to the UOP area. And instead of stopping at the bottom of the jump site, you're going to continue on down to the RTS parking lot across from Runamuck. So that's pretty easy and actually should be super nice. So couple other things to see. We also have had any number of comments from folks about just that it's pretty crowded out there and people seem to be using their earbuds a lot more maybe than they should. You know, for everyone's safety, maybe keep one earbud out if you like to cruise with the music, which I know I'm guilty of. So please try to just kind of think about that a little bit. And otherwise, I think we're just really on to another pleasant weekend here in Park City. And, gosh, just get out there, have fun, and remember it is crowded. Oh, one last thing. There's obviously, as you well know, there's more and more, if nothing else, talk, chatter about enforcing parking regulations, and there is some of that going on. So really in an effort to try to minimize that and maybe either get an expensive ticket or get towed, really try to adhere to the parking regulations at the trailheads that you're using. It would be super helpful. Not sure what the solution is. You know, the virus has certainly made the trails super popular and certainly not traveling together has made it difficult to park. So everyone just try to do their best out there. That's it, Leslie.
I got a few things for you. Hey, wanted to ask you, did the Mountain Trails Foundation, did you guys chime in at, during yesterday's discussion at Park City Council with regard to those e-bike tags?
No, we did not chime in. At least not, like I said, I was traveling. But we support the tag idea, even though it's not perfect. We do believe that at least letting the people who are legit make some effort to show they're legit, like I would be legit. So I support that. We hope that it will help ease some tensions out there. I mean, no one should be getting mad at anybody. Everyone's out to have a good time. But there's definitely we still support the idea that e-mountain bikes should be limited in their use in single track areas in Park City. So where you support the tag and we support certainly further investigation and the whole issue in the long run. It is something that's coming at us. We can't get around it. So, yes. Anyhow,
and then
what was the next question?
And what was about the 9,000 foot trail? You guys, I guess when's that going to be finished? This summer?
Well, Rick hates me to put it out there, probably. Yes, it has to be finished this summer. that is part of our grant. So, yeah, we would forecast probably, hopefully, by or before October 1st. If you've been out there, you know, a lot of people have been riding it. We consider it open over to Black Forest, Fat Lip area. It's beautiful trail. Certainly, people riding it, using it, hiking it helps beat it in some, so that's been good. Those guys are kind of headed towards the west face of Jupe at the moment, and you know, the plan is to come out over there by one of the big switchbacks going back to your right as you get up by Scott's Pass off of Blazing Saddles. So we're closing in. There's some obstacles in between, as you might well know. You see it up there a lot, that main bowl and Six Bells indicators, all those areas, Rhino Bowl, all present some challenges. So should be exciting work for those guys, and we're excited to get it done. It's going to be super cool when it's done.
Yeah, so, I mean, is this the idea behind this is just to make a more room on the trails? I mean, Mid-Mountain, of course, as you know, so popular, and this kind of gives another outlet to that, or what's the...
It does, but it also was a way to hopefully disperse parking off the Guardsman's Pass Road. So this is a little bit goes back into the Bonanza Flat Technical Committee satellite. You know, in an effort to get people off the top of the pass, you can now park down at the Bonanza Flat Loop, or I'm sorry, Bonanza Flat parking area, and actually be able to access the 9K. And you can do that from that parking lot, too, for Bloods Lake, because you can walk up to the 9K, walk over to the Bloods Lake parking, and then get on the Bloods Lake parking lot or parking trail right there and go. Gives you another probably extra mile and a half of hiking. And also keeps you out of the congestion. And then ultimately, Leslie, I mean, all you got to do is kind of fathom this from, just use your imagination for a moment, go, wow, this is a killer way to come down from Pinecone, or this is a killer way to do some just loops in the old town stuff that maybe you don't frequently use. And we will ultimately be connecting the 9K with a 9K connector down to Mid-Mountain that will be a flow trail that's scheduled for next year at this point.
Okay. And the challenges you mentioned, just lots of rock, I know, but what, just lots of trees as well?
Yeah, it's really steep. And if you know that area from the near side of the west face, going over to Six Bells Indicator, around the bottom of the main bowl, all those areas have outcroppings and so forth, and just will present some serious route finding. And I know Rick and Chris Vandalin have been up there for quite a bit, and they think they have a solid course, I believe, at this point to go all the way through.
Okay, Charlie.
It's going to be super exciting.
Yeah. All right. Hey, thanks. It's Charlie Sturgis with Mountain Trails Foundation. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Stay tuned. We'll be checking in with Park City Rotary Club President Corey Forsling. Well, one of Park City's favorite events, Miner's Day, is the latest casualty in the cancellation of special events due to the coronavirus pandemic. On the phone with an update, I have newly installed Park City Rotary Club President Corey Forsling, who took over leadership of the club July 1st. Good morning, Corey.
Hello. Happy to be here.
So did you, the Rotary Club, just follow suit and saw that everything else had been canceled this summer and knew that you kind of had to cancel as well?
Well, we have struggled with a choice. We knew that our event was at the end of this summer, and we were watching closely the other events, July 4th, Arts Festival, the market. But Miner's Day is important. It's special in our community. It is a celebration of our mining heritage. So we didn't want to rush to a decision. This would have been the 125th year of Miner's Day. The first event was in 1896, so we were looking forward to celebrating that. And our Rotary Club has organized this event for many years, so we really take it seriously. But from a community safety perspective, we just decided that we couldn't hold any events for the public. And but we have decided to continue with the virtual form of the running of the balls.
All right, so gone are the parade, the mucking and drilling, the kids' games, the live music, the food and beer in City Park. Tell me a little
all
bit.
All of that.
Yeah. So and the public display of running with the balls, which kind of kicks everything off for Miner's Day. But you still will be able to hold that virtually. Tell us about that.
We are planning to do that. It was important in deciding what to do for this event to keep that recognition of our mining heritage, because that is what we are celebrating every year, but then also to find a way to continue to raise money to support our community. We use the funds from Miner's Day. It is our largest annual fundraiser. We use it to support local nonprofits and scholarship programs, and so it was if we could, and this is a really rough year, as you know, but if we could, we wanted to continue that. So we landed on Running of the Balls. We will be doing a video version of the Running of the Balls that will be released on Miner's Day. That's going to look a little bit different. You know, we'll harken back to our old mining days with the Running of the Balls Tower. But rather than 10,000 balls bouncing down Main Street and 17,000 people crowding around the track, we are going to limit it to 300 balls. And we will have higher value prizes, higher chances of winning. But the proceeds will still go to support those nonprofits and scholarships that are important to us.
Okay. So where can people get balls, or have you already sold out?
We have not started yet. Everyone can watch for details on our club website, parkcityrotary.org. Plus, we will also make sure that we blast out the information when the time comes. And I think the video on Miner's Day is going the release on Miner's Day is going to be a lot of fun. They're working on a really great video, so we're looking forward to that. Our club is 40 years old at this point. We were founded in 1980, and we've contributed over $1 million to community causes during that time. And we really leapt into action during COVID-19 in the spring with food and hygiene supply drives. And so we just felt we wanted to continue this event as well. So we will release the information as soon as we have it.
Okay, so you're setting it up, what, in somebody's backyard or something, the track?
Well, we are working with the city right now. We actually are hoping to film on Main Street, but it'll be when there's no crowd.
Okay. Another part of Miner's Day, of course, is that you name Citizens of the Year, both volunteer and professional, and they serve as grand marshals. So are you holding off on a year, or are you still going to go ahead and nominate? Are people have been nominated and chosen? Or
yes, we actually we tossed around that one as well. As you know, this year is a lot of discussions and choices, but we do have two nominees, and they will be awarded the Citizen of the Year Awards on August 24th in a ceremony in Rotary Park. But because we're not having a parade, they are going to be grand marshals in the 2021 parade.
Okay.
So we are continuing with that. It's an important honor as well. So we are going to keep going with that.
Okay. Anything else people should know? I guess where are you going to release the information then, and when time comes for Running with the Ball sales?
All of the media will have information, plus Facebook, Instagram will be out there, so we'll spread the word far and wide. If we are always welcoming new members if anyone is interested in serving. Our website is parkcityrotary.org. Reach out, and we'd love to chat with you.
All right. Corey Forsling, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Corey Forsling is the newly installed president of the Park City Rotary Club. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, the Park City Chamber Bureau is funded by the transient room tax, but visitors are in short supply this summer season. Event cancellations and the uncertainty about resorts opening for winter make for a very difficult economic forecast. KPCW's Carolyn Murray has this update from the Chamber and Visitors Bureau.
Newly appointed board president Casey Metzger says businesses will have to get creative to withstand the economic impacts of COVID-19. He owns the local small business Top Shelf Catering, which is a service business that depends on large events. He says many local entrepreneurs have helped to shape the Park City community, and he can help to navigate the economic downturn.
Well, we're in the business of celebrating in large groups. So this COVID-19 train has completely derailed us, but we're getting scrappy and we're trying to save jobs as best we can. Just, you know, have our finger on the pulse and be very active in seeing what's out there for resources, which the Summit County, the city and the county and the chamber have been working diligently. And I've been very impressed with the efforts going forth to help small businesses. So, you know, that's my job, is to try to tread that water and make it to the other end. The sectors in our community, a lot of it has to do with hospitality. A lot of it has to do with service. And I think a lot of us are in the same boat.
Under a normal summer season, current Chamber and Visitors Bureau President and CEO Bill Malone says the area business is driven primarily by corporate meetings and special events. He says many of the hospitality businesses are on a thread, and surviving the economic downturn will be determined in the next couple of months.
you know, we're looking at our occupancy for the second quarter, which was April, May, and June. April, we were down 97%. May down 86%, and June down 74%. The good news is that, you know, they're trending in the right direction. The bad news is that, you know, that's a long period of time to weather the storm. In second quarter of 2019, the county collected a little over $800,000 in transient room taxes. This year, we're estimating that to be about $40,000.
Malone calls it a catastrophic shift from last year, representing the lost business revenues as well as the impacts on local jobs. Occupancy rates are running from 20 to 25% this season, but he says they're hopeful for the winter season. However, they have not heard definitive plans on local resorts opening.
A lot of people's travels, in terms of those that are comfortable going on the road and doing road trips and coming to places like Park City are making those decisions really close in, and they're watching the news. They're watching what the situations look like in the communities from a case standpoint. And so it's really different and very difficult to forecast, you know, down the road.
Malone says even with the extreme revenue shortfalls the chamber is experiencing now, they're still financially sound because they're using savings. He says they're somewhat optimistic for the fourth quarter. They're continuing to market to the Western regional traveler. Malone acknowledges the increased traffic congestion and the frequent sightings of out-of-state license plates would lead to more positive business trends. I'm Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
Well, among the recent incidents reported by the Summit County Sheriff's Department, deputies responded to the case of a stolen flag, a dispute over fireworks, and alleged peeping Tom caught on a rooftop. KPCW's Rick Bruff has more.
During the night of July 21st, a Francis resident reported that someone stole her pride flag, which displayed a peace symbol and the word peace. She said the flag was taken along with a PVC pipe and a piece of rebar that was holding it in place. The report said there was no video surveillance on the property and no suspect information. In another case, on the day after Pioneer Day, a 51-year-old Marion resident said that after his two sons used fireworks, a neighbor became upset. He said the neighbor screamed at his 15-year-old son and almost hit the other son, 13 years old, with the man's vehicle. After statements were taken from all the parties, the 54-year-old neighbor was cited for disorderly conduct, and the complainant was cited for reckless burning due to the fireworks ban in place. Finally, a 26-year-old Colville man was arrested for voyeurism against a child under 14 on the night of July 26th. According to the arrest affidavit, a 13-year-old girl told her parents that she heard footsteps on the roof above her bedroom. The parents saw the suspect on their roof and identified him as a neighbor they had met when they hosted a barbecue that same day. The suspect jumped off the roof into their backyard but was detained. Deputies said they found a screen had been pried away from the window of the girl's room.
Well, the Park City Council met 2 days this week, with the bulk of business being conducted last night. On the phone with a recap, I have Councilmember Tim Henney. Good morning, Tim.
Morning, Leslie.
Summit County Health Director Rich Bulla updated the council on the county's COVID-19 situation since putting the mask mandate in place just before the 4th of July holiday. He said Summit County's data looking quite good right now, but the state as a whole still has a ways to go. What was your biggest takeaway from the update?
Just that you know, the compliance by people, and it seems to be a very good high percentage of people who are being very diligent and complying. There were anecdotal stories from all sorts of people, including Rich himself, walking around town and specifically on places like Main Street and seeing almost everyone, not only people with masks, but people wearing their masks. And that's a change. You know, over the last month or so, we've seen people coming to Main Street when we shut it down on some of the early Sundays, and they would be carrying masks, and we handed out. I mean, I was there for a couple hours, and I handed out 100 masks one day, and
one of the early Sundays, and that's not necessary these days. You go out there on a Sunday now, and you'll see everybody wearing a mask, not just carrying them, and staff who's handing out masks are handing very few out because everybody seems to have their own. So the takeaway is people have accepted wearing the masks. They don't view it so much as a mandate, but as something that they're doing to be respectful and considerate of their fellow citizens and themselves, and it's working.
Bullo had said that the small businesses, the mom and pop shops, seem to have had the hardest time complying with the mask mandate. Anything you want to tell Park City small business owners about the requirement?
Well, what we've heard from everybody, whether it be small businesses, mom and pop shops on Main Street, or some of the bigger brand names, I don't see much of a difference. Everybody has told us that they appreciate the mandate because it takes the pressure off of them to request people to wear masks. So Rich might have been talking about other parts of the county. There does seem to be a difference between the west side and the east side and sort of how they view wearing the mask. On the west side, all of the merchants that I have talked to, and every bit of feedback that we've gotten has been that the mandate has helped them because they are not the people enforcing. And they can say, it's the law, and people get that. If they don't want to come in, they just turn around and walk away, which is the rare exception, and that people are accepting wearing the masks.
Councilmember Nan Worrell said that she had gotten a few questions about a timeline for opening the senior center. Rich did say that a vaccine looks to be ahead of schedule, but at-risk populations are still in the state's red risk level. So under what conditions will buildings like senior centers open?
Well, I think the message was that, you're going to have to talk to Rich about that. That's pretty much what we heard. I was unaware that high-risk populations were still considered in the red phase, so that was news to me. I thought that, everybody was kind of viewed as the same phase, but that's interesting, isn't it, that, you have seniors who are at higher risk and they're considered, they should be behaving and they should be treated as though they are in the red phase, which is very different than where everybody else is. So I kind of tease that one out with Rich.
Okay. 5G towers, city engineer John Robertson said several options available to Park City to install the 5G equipment, like special light post equipment being placed on top of buildings. How do we install these devices and not have it be an eyesore?
Well, we don't install. They install, but we permit where they can be installed, and we have some say as to what they can look like. And there are trade-offs. There's all sorts of trade-offs. But, the main issue with 5G is really, I hate to say it, but it's not really where they go and what they look like, even though that is a significant concern, and that's the area that we have some authority over. But the number one issue that we're hearing about is, and this is completely nobody, well, maybe one or two people have talked about, we have this wave of applications that's going to hit us from every provider, which I guess is actually factual in the case. So the handful of providers, the big names that we all know, T-Mobile, AT&T, Verizon, are all going to be looking to put small cell antennas throughout the town. They don't go very far, so they need lots of antennas, lots of to create the coverage that gives people 5G. But the concern is health. And it's the frequency impacts on health. And so what we talked about last night, not only in addition to the area that we have control over, but was that, the health board should be exploring this. The health department should be exploring this. That's under the purview of the Summit County Council. I know because I heard you do an interview that the Summit County Council is concerned about this issue and has called for a work session. So I expect the health aspects of this to be thoroughly explored. What we have been told is we have no authority over the health aspects of this. It resides exclusively with the FCC, and I would think that the only area within our local government that would possibly have any jurisdictional authority would be the health department, just like with COVID. The health department was the agency that had the authority to put in health orders that had, that did all sorts of things. So that's the only angle I see from a health standpoint. Nan Worrell is going to take it to Rich Bullo and also to the health board and bring it up for a topic of discussion there. But with respect to what we're doing, we can say where it goes, what it can look like, but we have also been told that we cannot prohibit it and we have to allow them in the public right of way. So it's putting us in a fairly difficult position because it's limiting what we can do, even with how they look and where they go. But we will be able to put height restrictions in. We will be able to create some sort of compatibility with the neighborhoods and put them on existing structures. And that's the intent.
Yeah. So if 5G does turn out to be dangerous, does the city have any legal protection here? Since it's in the city right away?
We've been told that because the authority resides with the FCC, that the city is indemnified. So that's what we're working under. And I think it would be like all sorts of things that you find out, after the fact, many decades later, that there were significant health issues. And, who knows where this goes? But to be preemptive, the only way that it can be preemptive is through the health department. And so I hate to say it, but, that's the place to take those concerns.
So there was some confusion as to whether or not the city will be enlisting the services of a third-party attorney to help navigate the process. Can you clarify that?
Well, I heard last night the mayor say that we'd be open to hearing from this third-party attorney who apparently is being talked about as making their services available and having some expertise in this area. So, we're available. We have a legal department. Our legal department has looked at it and said that, we don't have any authority. But if there's somebody that has new information, we're always available and open to learning.
Both you and Mayor Andy Bierman spoke quite strongly about the situation around the hideout annexation, saying the last-minute deals in the state legislature to create loopholes like the one in House Bill 359 are, in your guys' words, what makes people lose faith in government and gives local government a bad name. So how active is city government going to be in the effort to repeal some or all of the bill at next month's special session?
Well, we're being as active as we possibly can. We're working through Matt Dias, the city manager, who has great relationships with the League of Cities and Towns, as well as through our lobbyists, to assess the situation. And the assessment thus far has turned up that, everyone was misled. Everybody from senators to representatives that we have talked to, that we've engaged with, had no idea that this is what was happening. It was proposed, and this happens, Leslie. You even see it, with us when some minor issue comes along and it is it gets to the council for an approval. And we hear that it's, this is house cleaning and it's some technical stuff and we're just aligning with the state statute and it's been approved unanimously by the planning commission and the planning staff is in favor of it. I got to tell you, the scrutiny that receives is different than many other things. So that's what happened. It was proposed by some lobbyists. And it was sponsored by, some senator, a senator and a house or maybe, multiple sponsors as a technical cleanup, housekeeping. That is not what this was. This created a door that did not exist and then opened the door that did not exist. And every legislature that has been contacted has just been astounded that took place. So not only is there an issue with this bill that got snuck through through what I would say somewhat nefarious means, and I don't, I think that's a fair characterization. People feel very misled, and I think that they're very upset about that. So I expect to see something done at the legislature, which is good because it's a wrong that needs to be righted. And to me, Leslie, we work incredibly hard to engage with our constituents and to build trust. And I have to tell you, it is a very difficult thing to build confidence and trust in your local government and your local elected officials. It takes time, it takes effort, it takes energy. And one thing like this completely sets you back a long way for all the good work that is done. So that's the disappointing part to me. It just is beyond me how something like this could happen.
Yeah, and I've heard some concern expressed, though, that it may be too late. I mean, that the Hideout City Council could approve this annexation before the special session happens. I mean, I guess there's ways that, you know, and I guess I'm thinking back to the impact fees. I mean, we did it, and then it was, you know, repealed. So I don't know.
I'm hopeful that the state legislature can put some sort of a hold on any actions that might take place because they're going to review the statute. That's what I think we have done in the past, and the example that I would use was when we did a temporary zoning amendment. We put a temporary moratorium on zoning that was under review. So that's something that's available to us as a local government. I believe that is available to the state legislature, and my hope is they will be convinced to put something like that in place so that no damage can be done while they really scrutinize this and take a much stronger look at it, which they all seem to want to do.
All right. Let's see. You brought up how there's a lot of effort into getting people to visit Park City if they're within driving distance in order to stimulate the economy, but as we know, event after event has been canceled. Is there a difference between attracting tourism and hosting events that bring in visitors?
Yeah, you know, we teased that out a little bit last night, and Steve Joyce had a good perspective that I think is extremely accurate, which is there's a difference between holding an event that creates gathering, and the gathering is the crucial component. If you can, you know, bringing people to town from the 600-mile radius, which is where the marketing is going, the drive market, we seem to see good visitation. Our Main Street seems vibrant and active and busy with people now. Whether they're spending money or where they're spending money is a different matter. And, you know, I'll let you talk to the HPCA about that. But we're seeing, you know, you've anecdotally said you see a lot of traffic and cars and busyness. I see it too. When I go to Main Street, I see lots of people there. It's not a ghost town. So obviously there's some success in bringing people to town, but they're not all gathering in one location. They are able to physically distance. They are wearing their masks, and that's the difference. If you pack a bunch of people into a parking lot because you're going to do some sort of a race, and you've got, you know, participants, and you've got families, and everybody's there, and you can't really control physical distancing, and you can't control wearing masks, and some do and some don't, there's your problem. So that's where we landed. You know, we're just going to continue to look at events and whether they create gatherings. We're going to leave the discretionary authority with the event staff. They've done an excellent job with this thus far. All the big events that do create gatherings have canceled. And we didn't tell them to cancel. We just, you know, have set the direction that we do not believe it's the responsible thing to do, and we would set a very high bar for mitigation that we don't believe could be met, and they have opted to voluntarily cancel and do the right thing.
All right. The City Council last night also approved the Historic Park City Alliance's request for tomorrow to be one of three requested car-free Saturdays. Did you approve just August 1st or as well as the other two Saturdays?
The other two as well. Yeah, we approved the HPCA request. So all the Saturdays and the extension of the closure on Sundays through October. It was supposed to end sometime in September. They requested that it go all the way through October.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
We're getting through it, everybody, and keep up the good work, and what a great place to live. And, you know, the reason we have all these people coming here and we have second homeowners sticking around longer, and everywhere you look, you see pods of families, and I think they're kind of extended families. There's a whole different dynamic happening in town this year, much different than anything I've seen in the 28 years that I've lived here. I see more people in groups on bicycles and hiking and walking, getting around, and maybe that's a form of the new normal. I'm sorry to say that we are unlikely to be increasing transit service this year, and I know you've had a lot of conversations about trailheads and congestion and how people are getting to trailheads. Transit's not going to be an option apparently this summer. We're going to keep really the minimum service to provide transit to only transit dependent populations. So what you see now is what you're likely to get all the way into the winter, and we're discussing and assessing what the winter service will look like. So that is adding to the congestion at the trailheads, because people who would normally be riding transit with their bikes to get there are driving there. So we get that, we understand that, but that's the reality of what we're dealing with in one of the fallouts and hardships of COVID. So hang in there, good job, and have a good weekend.
All right, Tim, thanks for your time this morning. That's Park City Council member Tim Henney. The Park City Community Foundation has announced it is accepting applications for its second round of the Climate Grant Fund. On the phone with details, I have the executive director of the Community Foundation, Katie Wright. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So tell us what this is about, the Climate Grant Fund.
Absolutely. The Park City Community Foundation is really meant to tackle Park City's toughest challenges. And then we do that by investing in our people, our place, and our culture. And I think that when we think about place, we know that snow is both critical to our economy, but also to our way of life and our culture here in Park City. And global warming puts that absolutely at risk. You know, I think all of us here experience the impact of climate change viscerally when we have winter seasons without snow. And we know that the whole globe really needs to make this a top priority if we're going to reverse global climate change. So the purpose of the Park City Climate Fund is to fund innovative ideas that are born here in Park City.
Yeah, and it just feels like so much of the work that we had done to try and combat climate change has kind of gone out the window with the pandemic.
You know, I think that there's challenges in my own household with plastic bag use and some things that we're not feeling great about that are a part of, pickup groceries and things like that. On the other hand, I think we're seeing that working from home is viable for some people. Flying less is also viable. And so I think we'll come out with some good lessons. But the fact remains that pandemic or not, global climate change threatens human civilization, and we really have a short window to do something. And so we are committed to continuing to make these grants, even in this really tough global moment.
How much money do you have to award?
So we have at least $150,000, and we are actually actively raising money to increase that. We have a challenge grant from John and Christy Cumming, a $50,000 challenge grant. So any donation made to the fund will be matched. We were able to give $150,000 in our very first round. We made those grants back in February, and we plan on making another round of grants before the end of this year.
So are you happy with that first year of grants? I mean, did it do what you'd hoped it would?
Yeah, we are happy with them. I mean, I think understandably, things got a bit of a slow start. Those grants were awarded in February, and then the globe went on lockdown in March. But despite that, there has been progress. So we have three grantees. One was a zero waste initiative through Recycle Utah. We've seen progress in the city, and they're working hard towards the concept of a zero waste community. We have Tree Utah that is going to lead tree plantings. We know carbon sequestration is an absolutely critical part of the puzzle, and planting trees works. And so that will be something that is spearheaded this fall. And then we had our third grant to Utah Clean Energy. And they are working to support the implementation of a clean energy legislation that happened 2 years ago at the state level, and also are working to see how we can create better statewide policies for the built environment. The fact of the matter is, we can't have stricter building codes here in Park City. They have to be adopted at the state level. And the built environment is another really important intervention to reversing global climate change. So we're very excited about the three grantees. They are still hard at work getting the work done. And as we all know, these are tough issues that take time.
The window for the grants opened on Wednesday, July 1st. So we've had about a month, but they're closing quickly here next Thursday. So people need to get it in. Have you seen some come through the window already?
We have seen some, but as usual, we usually get most of the grants in kind of the last 48 hours. I think one thing I want to emphasize is that this grant program isn't just for nonprofit organizations. Nonprofit organizations are welcome to apply, but actually individuals and businesses, HOAs, are all invited to submit their best ideas. We know that we need to work quickly to reverse global climate change, and we want to source ideas and innovation from whoever has them. And the guidelines really stress, of course, impact on greenhouse gas emissions, but also potential for scaling and replicability. The Climate Fund came out of the MT 2030 efforts, Mountaintown 2030 effort, and our thought is that if an idea works well in Park City, perhaps it could be scaled and replicated in other mountain town communities. And then, of course, we look to see that the idea is feasible and cost effective as well.
I'm guessing that mountain town conference for this year has been canceled. I think it was going to be in Colorado somewhere.
Yes, it has been canceled, unfortunately, but the mountain towns are convening virtually to share best practices. And we've seen a lot of forward momentum in towns adopting that net zero 2030 goal. And now it's how do we work towards it? So that effort is alive and well and has already had some really good progress.
Okay. August 6th at Thursday by midnight, you've got lots of information on your website to
absolutely. Visit our website, parkcitycf, as in communityfoundation.org. And there's a lot of information there about applying, and we hope we get ideas from all sorts of people around our community.
You're also looking for nominees for the annual Tricia Worthington Community Service Award. What's this? Tell us about this award. I mean, why? What kind of nominees would you be looking for?
Yeah, well, I had the pleasure of working for Tricia at the beginning of the Community Foundation's founding. She's an absolutely phenomenal person, and has dedicated her career to charitable and community endeavors. So past awardees have included longtime volunteers, people who work in the nonprofit sector. And so we really hope that people will nominate that hardworking individual who puts community good first. And the winner gets to donate $1,000 to their favorite nonprofit, which is fun.
Okay. And again, the details of that, you need to have a nomination in by when?
August 4th.
Okay. And again, that can be found online as well with the nomination form.
Yep. All the information is on our website.
You are also hiring. You have an opening for a full-time position, Grants and Impact Manager?
We do. And we probably will have another position open in the next month or so. We have two fabulous employees who are moving on to a different stage in their life adventures. So we are looking for a grants and impact manager. This is a fantastic job. It runs all of our grant programs and works really hand in hand with nonprofits, helping with our nonprofit education, you know, Live PC, Give PC, and anything like that. So it's a really great job, and we hope to find wonderful candidates. So that is also on our website.
Okay. What's the second job that's coming up?
The second job is not yet posted, but it is a fundraising position. I think that there is no greater joy in life than connecting people to the ability of doing good work. And so that should be posted in the next couple weeks.
All right. And finally, I wanted to mention the nonprofit workshop. This is something you do usually in May, but it was postponed. You're going to do it as a virtual two-day event in October. Interesting topic, racial equity and nonprofit communications and storytelling. Can you give us more information about that?
Yes. So we, a core part of our mission is to serve the nonprofit community and becoming more effective at delivering their mission. And we also are very focused on creating a more equitable and inclusive Park City. So nonprofits do a lot of communications and a lot of storytelling, and I think we all look to improve how we can elevate different folks in our community and their stories in a way that is fair and, again, elevating. And so this isn't always an easy thing to navigate. So we have a nonprofit workshop. It will be virtual. October 6th, October 7th. It will be at the very affordable rate of $30. And we highly recommend that anyone who works or volunteers for a nonprofit consider joining us for this education. And, you know, we know that becoming a more equitable organization than a more equitable community is a long haul of education and practice. And so this is one thing we're offering in the near future. And I for one, am very excited to participate.
Yeah, you've got a couple of videos online, and certainly one of them a little bit rough on the edges, but pretty eye-opening by a woman. And I don't know, I can't remember her name, but basically talking about explaining, you know, the whole protesting and rioting and looting situation. And really from, like I say, very eye-opening for somebody coming from my position. So I would encourage people to go check those out.
Yes, I think I know I've learned a lot and continue to have a lot to learn.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention? Oh, what's the latest with the Community Impact Fund?
Yeah, thank you for asking. We have hit a milestone of granting out $1.1 million through the Community Response Fund. About $700,000 of that has gone to Jewish Family Service and Christian Center to provide rental assistance. We are very focused on keeping families stable, whether it's food security, health access, or, you know, housing. And so I just can't say how overwhelmed I think we are at the Community Foundation with the generosity of our community in ensuring that people who are left in a tough spot are able to remain stable and care for their families. We will continue to prioritize urgent needs, and we know that this is going to be a really long haul. But we've also been in the position to make what we're calling stabilization grants to nonprofits. We want at the other end of this pandemic to have our nonprofits here and sustained because we know how important they are to our community. So we were able to make stabilization grants as well. So it's been amazing to see how we can all come together, and we've had donors of all sizes contribute to that fund.
Okay. Katie, hey, appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Leslie.
Katie Wright is Executive Director of the Park City Community Foundation. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, sales at Utah's state-run liquor stores topped $500 million in a year for the first time ever. It appears that the increases in prices rather than more alcohol consumption is what driving the increase. Numbers released by the Utah Department of Alcoholic Beverage Control this week show that the state took in more than $500 million in fiscal year 2020, which ended June 30th. According to a report in the Deseret News, sales were up, even though the overall number of bottles sold for the year was down 3.5 million, about 7% from last year. Officials said moving the heavy beer to grocery stores last November may have accounted for that drop. Sales figures were up even though state liquor stores were operating on reduced hours and restaurants and bars were buying less because of the coronavirus pandemic. Some state liquor stores briefly closed after employees tested positive for COVID-19. State alcohol sales were more than $479 million last fiscal year.
Morning Edition and the Local News Hour with Leslie Thatcher is brought to you in part by Intermountain Park City Hospital, Intermountain Heber City Hospital, and the Red Ledges Community.
64 degrees here in Old Town Park City. Forecast today calling for another hot one. Sunshine with a high of 92. Hot weekend as well, looking for highs into the low 90s, both Saturday and Sunday, with overnight lows into the 60s. You've been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW Park City. Have a great weekend.